I ate so much, I'm probably looking to fall asleep. So, I thought last night would be gross. So a couple things. One is, right after this session, we're going to all go out together and take a new picture. So please don't take off before we can do that. We'll probably go until about maybe 3 or just maybe a little bit after. So we'll just kind of see how things go. Or if we end early, that's fine too. There is something I want to share with you after we go through this. Quote we have in the book, Our Thoughts Determine Our Lives, Our Values. But I have something I want to kind of conclude with from one of the books of St. Paisley. But let's go ahead and just take a look. Hopefully you had an opportunity last night to look at this quote, to read it, to reflect on it. Because today, this morning, what we want to do is get some interaction going and getting your thoughts on this particular quote. And maybe even seeing it through the lens of what we talked about last night and what we talked about today, maybe there's new language that you would use to sort of understand this. You may have questions about the quote. You have comments, hopefully you have comments about the quote. So let's just open up the floor, and I want to get some dialogue going and some input from all of you. And again, I'm assuming you read it. If not, take 30 seconds to read it, or 20 seconds. Just speak to maybe what jumps out at you when you see this. Yes?
I would say the word quiet is the word quiet.
The word quiet. Yeah, so I think that is, this is at peace. Okay, we must strive to always be kind, good, and quiet. And then it's used again, right? At peace, so that people will always feel peace and quietness in our presence. So why does that jump out at you? What is it about that word?
Because I think generally people say too much.
People say too much, okay. Anybody else, did that jump out at you in terms of that word?
I think it jumped out at me, but I was recently at a funeral, and the man was in his late 80s, very peaceful man, fantastic. I mean, in the church we considered him like a saint. And his son was telling me that he, at his prayer, he has a scripture from Thessalonians 4:11. And so I looked at 4:11, and there are three things. And I don't know that I'll remember all three, but I'll remember two. One is live a quiet life. So that kind of relates to that.
What is
it? Live a quiet life.
Live a quiet life.
Oh, okay, I know all three. Live a quiet life, work with your hands, work hard, and mind your own business.
Quieting our mind in order to be present with God. But we also have to do that when we want to be fully present with another person. Have you ever noticed, and I do this a lot of times when I just do relationship building things, especially with couples, and we talk about some of the seminars, but we can't be fully tuned into another person and formulating our answer at the same time. Those, again, those are two things that can't coexist. So to set our own thought process, in a sense, aside, to be really present with this person, to listen very, very carefully to not just the content, but certain words that are being used, even to be aware of certain nonverbal things. When I was working at the graduate school, one of the things that we were working on with the students is to learn to be observant, not only the content message of the client, but the nonverbal message, the tone, the volume, the pitch in their voice, body postures, head movements, eye movements, all of these sort of things that communicate a lot of information. But if you're just listening to what's coming out of their mouth, you're going to miss a lot of things. And when I do premarital counseling, there's a communication exercise we do, and where one of the individuals just articulates a request or something that they wish that person, the other person, would do more or less often. And in the words that they use, it's really interesting because the recipient of the message is interpreting what's being said. And they're only being asked to reflect what's being said. But they usually interpret what's being said. And then they get some way off base. But what's interesting is I find so often is that when people, we use words, but there's usually a word that's a very packed word with meaning. And that's the word that we need to like grab onto. Like if someone says, you know, I would like it if we could spend more time together because when we don't, I feel abandoned. And he says, so you're saying that you would just like to spend more time together, right? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, wow. What does she experience when you don't feel, when you're not spending time together? He goes, I don't know, what was it you said? That's a perfect case in point. People use very loaded words oftentimes in their messages, and those are the words that I, in my vocation, are really trained to take that word and say, you know, I noticed that you used this word when you were describing that. Can you say a little bit more about that word? Because that word has a lot of meaning to it. I want to know what it means to you when you say it. That helps them to sort of unpack it. But we can't do that unless we're really still and quiet and observant and noticing and present and all of that. And what happens in the illustration I gave is that the man, for example, it's usually the man because men are like the worst at listening. The man is sitting there and he's already, you know, interpreting what's being said. He just wants to speak. Or what happens most of the time is that men always try to fix problems. They don't sit with people in their problems. They just want to fix it. And in my the other habit, where we call that therapeutic aggression. Therapeutic aggression. That when someone speaks about something very deep and meaningful, if I feel uncomfortable, I'm either going to try to solve the problem or I'm going to change the subject. Ah, it's okay. Hey, what are we doing later tonight? You know? Because I'm not comfortable. So to sit with somebody who's divulging and pouring things out, it takes a lot of attunement, attentiveness, and listening to those sort of things. But this is how my crazy mind works. When I hear the word quiet, it's like all of these things. But ultimately, I think, you know, what Thaddeus is talking about here is really just that peaceful stillness.
Also, quiet is critical if it's not combined with kindness, love, and peace. It can be a matter of disengaging, too. So there are people who are quiet, and they always are quiet.
Yeah, but they're being passive aggressive.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, if you don't have something
to kindness, men do that in the world, too. They're being master passive aggressive.
Look at Father Gorman. He's really good.
I'm just saying.
He's being quiet.
Just keep what?
I just hate it. No, that's a great point. I mean, it's that element that he brings up in terms of kindness and goodness, that is so important in the process of that as well, especially when we're sitting with somebody in relationship with them. Not in the sense of being with God and being still in our minds and thoughts so that we can be more attentive to Christ in our midst, but certainly when we're with other people. There was a woman in San Bernardino, and I forget her name. She didn't come that often, but one Sunday she came up to me after liturgy and after I had out on the adido, and she just wanted to inform me that she had terminal cancer. And we talked for a while, and I met with her later on that week, and within, you know, 2 or 3 months, she passed away. But one of the things she talked to me about shared with me, and it was on the, you know, the little thing they have at funerals that say when they're born and when they passed away and a little bit about their life. She had this saying that is still saying it. And she said, and it really comes from St. Paul, but she says, wherever you go, don't forget to leave the fragrance of Christ behind you. I was like, that's really cool. That's beautiful. Wherever you go, and I think like my mom, you know, she wore like perfumes and stuff. Whenever she'd walk by, you'd like smell pop or whatever. And so I think this idea of the fragrance of Christ has a lot to do with this too. That when we leave an interaction with a person, we should always leave the fragrance of Christ with them. What does that mean? Because we're not talking about myrrh. I mean, that would be great, but that would probably be dead, but it's actually holy, so that's probably not going to happen. But what does it mean to leave the fragrance of Christ behind?
Love. His essence.
Okay.
The essence of your life.
How is that? How do we do that?
To try to be like an example to walk. Walk as you walk.
Okay.
Practice the act.
Okay.
Love.
Okay. Have you ever been in the presence of another person, and then when you walked away from them, your heart was just sort of full of joy and peace, and even maybe some stillness? That's what I'm talking about. That's a unique individual who you just came face to face with. Because it was something about them that they had the presence of Christ within them, that when they left, the fragrance remained in your heart, in your experience, and you felt something really strong, peace, something good, you know. That's a special gift. That's something I think that in our strivings, because I think when we think about like the spiritual life, and you know, I want to become, you know, it says be holy for God is holy, and all of this, and so I do all these things to try to become more Christ-like. I think we put so much emphasis on doing stuff to be that way, as opposed to just sort of resting and saying, Lord, grant me the ability and grace to do these things, because I can't go out and just earn this. This is something but we have to make room for God in order for that to happen. Because ultimately, we want to, when Christ said, let your light so shine before others so that they may know your Father who is in heaven, this is the same thing as saying, wherever you go, leave the fragrance of Christ. We want to be that presence. But we can't do it unless we put ourselves aside and we allow that grace and all of these things to enter into us. So this is a beautiful saying that St. Paul speaks about. And I just put that seed in you just to think about it, you know. Because anything we want to accomplish that's good and holy is only going to happen because we are asking Christ to make it happen within us. Now, obviously, we have to use our free will as well, but ultimately, that's the way it's going to happen. So, okay, what else in this particular reflection here? Yes?
Essence. We know that we either attract people with our thoughts or drive them away from us. Mm-hmm. That's super, super powerful. I mean, just from your thoughts, if you attract people, and I think it's true. Some people know that when you're near them, They don't say anything to you. They might even smile at you, and they might say hello to you, but you know they're not that crazy. So that's what I mean.
Did everybody hear that?
Not quite.
Can you say it maybe a little bit more, but out that way, so they can hear you too? Can you please stand up?
So did you hear what sentence I think? Oh, yeah. All right, so then I'll tell the sentence. We know that we can either attract people with our thoughts or drive them away from us just by our thoughts. And so I was saying how sometimes with me, I'll see somebody and they'll say hello to me and I know that they love me. I just know that. They don't even have to say anything, but I know there's some kind of thing there. And other people, they might smile at me, they might say hello to me, but they're not interested. So yeah. So anyway, that was interesting. Just by our thoughts, we can attract people or push them away.
What else? Yes.
Go ahead, please. I would say, I just on a very simple level, this reminds me of my mother, because right before I got married, she said, "Just remember, dear, you can't change people, so don't try."
Actually, a serenity prayer.
Well, yeah, I know.
So that's what it reminds me.
That's the next level.
Yes. So that's the first sentence. We must begin with ourselves and not try to change others.
But then we change ourselves. You cannot change something.
Yes.
It
goes back to the external versus the internal locus of control I talked about. We may not be able to change a person because they have to actually enact the change themselves. But we can bear influence on people.
Especially if you're a Serbian.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, and I don't know the monk, but there was some monk from Mount Athos, his writings, and I read it a long time ago, and it struck me, and I try and remember it when I'm mad at somebody for how they behave towards me. I'm not very good at it, but what he basically was saying is when someone insults him or causes grief, he says, Don't ever be angry with that person. Ask yourself, what am I doing wrong to have created that person to act like this? If I'm not loving enough or kind enough, because if you're kind and loving enough, they're not going to want to hurt you because you're really being like Christ. And it's a great thing to try and achieve. I'm not there, but I'm working on it. It's been a long process.
You know, I would also say that is a very advanced, spiritually advanced comment. And I say that because in the work that I do with people, especially who have been traumatized, to take the blame on is not the right thing to do. Like someone who's been abused. So I get what he's saying.
Yeah.
Because I understand it within the context of what he's talking about. It, you know, it's like, you know, in some ways, St. Paul, who says, "I am the chief and the worst of all sinners." But what it does do is it does speak to this sort of self-reflection of not how I, what can I do in order to change them, but what do I need to do in order to make the changes within myself? Like, there's a quote here that's very similar to St. Seraphim of Sarov, who said, you know, acquire the spirit of peace and 1,000 souls will be saved around you. So this is, our work is always to acquire that peace, the peace from above, anothen, which is that peace that doesn't go away no matter what our circumstances. And to have that sense of peace is really what permeates in the interactions that we have, whether they're verbal or nonverbal, but it's that sense that people have of the peacefulness of Christ within another individual that impacts their hearts to such a point that it affects them in a very, very profound way. Does that make sense? Yeah. What else?
I guess if you're going to correct yourself, you have to admit that there's something to correct.
Yeah, it takes awareness, honesty. Look, I mean, this is really the essence of our preparation for confession. You know, over the years as a priest, I've had people come to confession and literally say, well, Father, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I'm sure I've done some things, but, you know, basically I've lived a good life, and I've always tried to treat people fairly, and I don't think I've really ever hurt anybody, and maybe, you know, messed up here and there. But that, to me, is not a soul that has been really having deep reflection about themselves. That, to me, is a very guarded soul. You know, I don't want to make myself vulnerable in front of you. Even if that person could at that one time, which I don't think they can. So, you know, the saying in Scripture is, let every man examine himself and then, you know, approach Christ. And so this whole idea of self-examination from a spiritual perspective in terms of our preparation for confession is just a very honest and open, vulnerable reflection of ourself and being tuned into our thoughts, our words, our actions, and all the ways that we have stumbled and missed the mark. And Christ is the mark. So when we're not hitting the mark, we're not imitating Christ. So we reflect on these things, and then we come with humility and really contrite spirit to offer our confessions to our Lord and Savior through the priest who's been given that authority. So it's a really good point. If I don't know I have a problem, then, or that I need to change, then what's the big deal? In the field of addictions, we would call that being at the pre-contemplative stage. So let's say you have an individual who, you know, is drinking a lot, maybe doing some drugs, and they've lost their license, their spouse left them, their job was taken away because they weren't consistent, and yet they say, you know what, I don't know what everybody's making such a big deal about. I know I've had some hard luck, and I know that I got in trouble with the law a little bit, and they let me go to work, but they're letting me alone. All this sort of justification and making up excuses. But they're in that pre-contemplative stage. They don't really see the need or that they have any issue. And there's really nothing you can do to convince people in that state that they have an issue. There's so much resistance and denial. So much resistance and denial. And then the contemplative stage is like, I wonder if there's a connection here with all the stuff that's been going on in my life and drinking. I mean, it kind of makes sense. So they're in that contemplative stage. And then the stage after that is like, I got a problem. And I know that I can't just wish it away. It's something I got to face and deal with and get some help with. So I see that parallel in the Orthodox spiritual life too. There are some people who just don't come to confession ever. And they may not. I've confessed people on their deathbed. They said it was the first time. You know, so, and they've been Orthodox all their life. So, you know, this is there's a parallel. Even Elder Thaddeus, I mean, if you read the book, Hard Thoughts Determine Our Lives, which I encourage you to read this book, because it's just an incredible book. One thing I really like about it is he's very transparent. A lot of times when you read the lives of the saints, it's like, you know, they weren't nursing from their mother's breast on Wednesday, Fridays, because it was fasting, and, you know, by the age of 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, they weren't playing with kids and games because they were reading, you know, the Bible. I mean, all these things, I'm like, okay, that doesn't relate to me. I can't connect with that. It's really neat, and it's beautiful, that. But when I read him, you know, this guy couldn't cut his smoking habit. He was bouncing around monastery, thinking that things around him had to change, that he'd feel a little bit more comfortable where he was. And I'm like, okay, that's something I can relate to. That makes sense to me. So I think he himself was really living sort of in denial about his own struggles. And he was making excuses for himself. And then, I think at one point in time, it's been like 7 years since I read the book, but I think there was a time where Christ actually spoke to him and said, you know what, you got to stop bopping around monasteries, you're going to stay at this one. You know, it's not the monastery. It's you. Yeah, for real. And that's true for our lives. You know, that's very, very true for our lives. And so, when we can stop and just be honest with ourselves and say, you know, there's a lot going on inside of me that's preventing me from really the desire, the things that I want in life, in terms of my spiritual life. So that's where I need to focus. And I don't need to be brutal about it and beat myself up. I need to accept God's love and mercy and compassion. But I also have to be honest and just sort of reflect on these things so that I can, you know, begin to live that life that I know Christ wants me to live. Does it make sense?
What sentence we could
do? The first one.
You want to bring in
the kindred souls seek each other out, both here and there.
Yeah, well, I have to be honest, it's been a long time since I read the book, and I don't know the context in which that quote is in there. If someone knows the context, that would be helpful.
It was in the chapter. What chapter is it on?
What chapter?
Yeah, because this was part of a reflection of life with God. I don't know what it was. I don't have the book.
Well, it's just, if it's just the semantics piece of here and there, it could be like everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, if it's like here and there.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it might not be that dramatic. Right? It's like poor here. Everybody can see each other. I'm not just here at church, but in the secular world or wherever you are, you find yourself attracted to the kindred souls. That's how it's pretty.
I think that's the important part, too, is that the kindred souls seek each other out.
Yeah, wherever you are.
Irregardless, right, of where. But when you think of kindred spirits, what do you think of? Or kindred souls? What do you think of? I mean, what do you think he's speaking of?
People committed to Christ.
You hear it all the time, right? We're cut from the same cloth. We're kindred spirits. We're whatever. Like-minded.
Values.
That's a great 21st century word.
Vibe.
Yeah. It's very in vogue.
What's the word?
That's true. Even songs talk about vibe. Don't mess with my vibe.
Presence, yeah.
No, I like it. I use that language around my kids all the time. Values and your goals, and really what's meaningful and purposeful in life, kids in families that are really strong families and have good family atmosphere and good marriages and kids that have good values and parents that have good values and all. I mean, this is what we desire most because we know the power of influence. And we see good kids coming from good homes getting caught up in bad situations and going off on really bad paths and getting harmed by that. So this is a huge thing for us. We desire that they find someone who they can have that really good relationship with. So I would say for sure that kindred souls do seek each other out. I think we have our invisible antennae, and we're looking for that person to have that special kind of connection with. And it can be just a friend, right? It can end up being a relative eventually. I mean, whoever, but we definitely seek this out. Anything else on this one? Alright. Do you mind if I share something else with you real quick?
Please.
Do you have permission to share something?
Sure, absolutely.
Alright, let me see if I can find it here. Oh, actually, sorry. Yeah. So this was, I actually had some of the quotes that I had from my sermon on Sunday. But I thought this would be sort of a nice conclusion. And we can, you can reflect on this as well. And then I want to also open it up to anything you want to ask or talk about or share regarding the whole retreat this weekend, yesterday evenings and this morning. Is anything we talked about, any questions you may have, or any thoughts you want to offer, we can do all of that after I give you this quote. But I think this would be sort of a nice thing to end on. For me, it's a very encouraging and positive thing. So St. Paisius says, it's a great thing to put oneself into the hands of God. People set goals and try to achieve them without listening carefully to hear the will of God without trying to conform to it. We must entrust ourselves to God and allow Him to direct our life while we do our duty with philotimo. If a person does not entrust himself to God so as to abandon himself entirely to God's hands, he will be tormented. People usually first turn to human consolation, and when disappointed by them, then they take refuge in God. But if we want to avoid being tormented, we must first seek divine consolation, which is, after all, the only true consolation. It is not enough merely to have faith in God. One must also have an absolute trust in God. Trust in God attracts his help. The Christian believes and entrusts himself to God unto death, and then he can see clearly the hand of God guiding and saving him. The Apostle Paul says that faith is believing in things we don't see, not merely in things we do see. When we place our future into God's hands, we oblige him to help us. Do you catch that? When we place our future, our lives, into God's hands, he is obliged, he is obligated to help us. Because he said this. We would never think to speak in that way. Lord, you are obligated to help and take care of me. One who is bold in spirit and trusts God will speak that way without hesitation. Absolute trust in God is born of faith with which we pray in secret and enjoy the fruit of hope. It is a constant prayer which brings divine results at the right time. It is then that man lives an angelic life and bursts out in paradise. For man, this is profound, for man can make of his life here a life of paradise. If he trusts God, praises him for everything, and accepts him as a loving father, guiding his life. Otherwise, he will make his life hell. It is a wonderful thing for a man to be able to experience from this life a measure of the joy of paradise. That really struck me. For man can make of his life a life of paradise in this life, if he trusts God and praises him for everything and accepts him as a loving father guiding his life. I know, Father St. Paisios experienced this. He literally experienced life on earth as paradise because the amount, the trust and the faith and the love that he had for God and the hope that he placed in him and accepting everything that happened allowed him to make this life a paradise. Our life does not need to be a living hell. That to me speaks of that has a tremendous amount of hope all over in a sense. Now, I'm not ignorant to think that this is not something that our mind and heart is kind of saying, well, my life's been a living hell so far because of what I've experienced. We're not talking about changing the past. We're not talking about sort of creating our own future. What we're talking about here is that life can become a paradise here for us if we trust in God and thank Him and praise Him and have that spirit of grateful indebtedness for everything from this time moving forward. It takes a lot to be thankful to God even for the struggles that we've gone through. It takes a lot to do that. It takes a lot of trust, but at the same time, we know we work often from a trust deficit. And I always go back to saying the same thing, and I said it to someone today in confession, I don't know who it was, so it doesn't really matter. But wherever we find ourselves at a deficit in terms of the virtues, ask God to begin to fill us with that virtue. If it's trust, then it's trust. If it's faith, then it's faith. If it's love, then it's love. If it's hope, then it's hope. If it's all of them, it's all of them. Make your living. And ask God to grant you these things every single day. Make those petitions. God is obligated to grant them to us. Ask, and it will be given to you. In Jesus Christ's name, it will be given to you. He said that. God cannot go back on that. He cannot, at this point, put contingencies on it. That is a very human way of functioning. That's not a divine way of functioning. So, this really falls in our lap. And I don't mean to oversimplify it, but it's a lot simpler than what we think it is. I think we put so much emphasis on our human effort that we fail to really engage our Lord in the way He wants us to engage and to give us exactly what we're lacking in order to be more what He wants us to be. Because again, we are being brought up in a very independent, self-sustaining sort of society. Be strong, white knuckle, power through it, get it done. We're being evaluated, we're being judged, it's all performance-based. And we operate out of that in the spirit, in the spiritual life, and we will not move from where we are, I guarantee you. In another place, St. Paisios says, do you think God expects you to progress in the spiritual life? And he says, no. That's crazy. Because as a priest, I hear this constantly in spiritual discussions with spiritual children, in confession, just the lamenting of not progressing. Oh, it's the same sin, Father, over and over and over again. And if you listen to my homily last Sunday, the main point I made, is that if we were to focus on asking God to increase love within our hearts, to enlarge it so that we can love Him more and love others more, which are the two greatest commandments, then the struggle against committing the same sin over and over and over again will take care of itself. Because you cannot love someone deeply, truly, and live a life that continually harms that person. And St. Paul Ephesians says, don't put your mind and worry and struggle in sin, in the fight with sin, in the battle of sin. You're going to get caught up and turned around so much, and the devil's just going to throw out all sorts of things, like despair and dejection and all this. Focus on the love of Christ and asking God to give you all of those things which you know your soul desires in order to be closer to God and to have that communion with God. Then these things begin to take care of themselves. These things begin to fade away. It's where we're putting our attention and focus that oftentimes makes it very difficult for us. When you experience true, unconditional, abiding love from someone, don't you want more than anything just to be pleasing to that person because you love them? You're not trying to be pleasing to them because you're afraid of being punished, and you're not trying to be pleasing to them because you want to get something out of the relationship. You want to be pleasing to them in a sense because you love them and you experience their love for you. This is the highest level of relationship in with God the Father saying. There's the relationship of being a slave, fear of punishment, that of a servant, wanting to have something as a reward, and that of sons and daughters. That we are obedient to follow the Father simply because we know His love and we love Him so much that we wouldn't think of doing something like that. Why would we do that? Why would I want to do that? But if I'm so caught up in the doing of stuff, that's where I'm going to get entangled. Does that make sense? I know that's a shift. I have one spiritual son who he's been my spiritual son for a long time. I've been talking to him about this, and he would, like, even in confession, say, "Oh, I just can't believe it. I'm so sorry. I keep doing this thing over and over." And he would just be so downcast. He says, What can I do? I mean, is there a book I can read? Should I do more frustrations? And maybe if you give me a penance? And I'm sitting there like, oh, you're making me depressed. And so it was interesting that after my homily, so in our church, after we have our homily and we have the liturgy and all that, and then right after liturgy, everybody goes into the fellowship hall, we have coffee, they ring a bell, all the kids go to Sunday school, and all the adults come back and we do theology 101. So it's like an adult kind of education thing. So, but that's time to ask questions about the epistle, the gospel, to kind of reflect on what was being said, and then if we prepare something else, we can talk about that. So I talked about that in my homily, and I really fleshed it out even more in Theology 101, and he came up to me afterwards and goes, I think I'm getting it. I think I'm finally beginning to understand what you're saying. And I said, I'm not saying it. I said, but that was, I said, 3/4 of my sermon, I was quoting a saint. That's not me saying it. I'm not making this stuff up. You know? He says, I think I'm finally getting it. But what I noticed, as he said it, he had peace on his face. And that to me was more rewarding than the words he was saying. Because I knew that he was finding peace in his soul as he began to understand. That's all I have for you. So you're free to questions, comments, or we can go to the picture. This is what they call it. reflect on it. I find that if I have forgiven somebody, and I truly believe in my heart I have, but this nagging thought comes back of the sin against me, let's say, I see that as simply a temptation where the devil's just trying to hook me and engage me and to turn me all upside down. So remember that the spiritual warfare, as I said before, takes place in the mind against the thoughts. St. Pius used to talk about thoughts that are all around, and he never uses the metaphor that thoughts are like planes, and you don't think of a place to land in your head. In other spiritual Orthodox literature, they talk about the thought comes and knocks at the door. You hear it, you know what it is, but don't open the door. If you do, you consent, and once you consent, you get into dialogue, and you take it to the next stage, and then it stirs up your heart, you feel angry, now you're sinning, you know, all of those sort of things. So I would say that if it were me, I would say, Lord, I have this nagging thought. Maybe this means I haven't fully forgiven. And if that's the case, please help me to have the grace to fully forgive that person. If I have fully forgiven, and it's a temptation, please give me the grace to ward that off and not to engage it. And that's how I would speak to my Lord about it. I just want to talk.
Something just going on with that example, because that's all I have to do. Don't forget. Could it, what if somebody stole from you, for example? I just pulled that out.
Yeah.
And I will forgive you for taking what is mine, but I don't want to do business with you again.
Correct.
So it could be in that respect that
that's
you're
fine.
I won't forget what happened. I will forgive you, but I will not deal with you again.
You know, we spoke about this. We had a three-part series up at our church where we brought in our pediatrician who gave a talk on how to build resiliency in yourself and your kids. And then a week later, we had another person come in and talk about addiction, especially sexual addiction to pornography for teens and the parents. It was actually for the parents. And then the third one was we had a person come in from an organization called Cares Northwest that works primarily with kids who have been sexually molested or abused. And they do all evaluations, and they have medical people on staff and social workers and all those sorts of things. So we have them come in as well. We just felt that this is the real world we live in. These are our kids are growing up. And so we wanted these people, none of them were Orthodox, but just came in and spoke in their area of expertise, and it was really helpful. One thing that we talked about that was really helpful, though, I think, because that was a question that came up, is what do I do as an Orthodox Christian where I'm supposed to forgive, and yet this person was my perpetrator? What do I do with that? You know, there was sort of a sense that if I forgive, that I may be condoning, and there was also the sense that, does that mean I have to have a relationship, even if it's sort of not so close relationship, whatever? And I think a really important point to make here is that when we have been, when our boundaries have been crossed and we've been violated because of that, yes, we are asked to forgive. That is not something that we can rush anybody into. There is a lot of work that needs to be done around forgiving, especially in traumatic events like that. So it's not like, look, you're an Orthodox Christian, you need to forgive them right now, and this is what God's asking you to do. That would be the most pastorally insensitive therapeutic request that we state that anybody could ever. It's just wrong. It's wrong. Is it a goal eventually? Yeah. But we don't even need to talk about it. Just put it over there and just leave it alone. Forgiving someone does not mean that you then bring down all of those healthy boundaries. And so you do say, and like you said, you stole from me. I do forgive you. And I'm not going to do this again. So it is good and right and healthy to set boundaries. But that doesn't mean we haven't forgiven, right? Listen, I remember St. Pius was saying to us, there was a young man who came from Thessaloniki to see him. And he was giving him, you know, listening to him, talking to him, and saying, this is what you need to do, and this is blah, blah, blah. He'd go home and come back, and he wasn't doing anything. He kept doing it like three or four. So finally, one day, St. Pius was sitting there talking to a couple of people, and this kid comes up to the gate. So he had a little hut, and there's like this huge fence around, and he had like a courtyard around his little hut. There's a little gate there, and had a little can of dried chickpeas, you know, that's his philosophia, his hospitality. And the young man says, Yaronda, I need to talk to you about something. He just keeps talking to this man. Yaronda, it's really, really important. I have to talk to you. And he says, Figabobo, leave, go away from here. So the gentleman who's sitting with St. Pius is like, that was rude. You know, thinking to himself. And the kids keeps, you know, bugging him. And he says, just get out of here. Just leave. So the kid leaves, and the guy goes, I'm sorry, forgive me for it, but why did you tell him to leave? He says, because he comes here, and he asks for help and advice, and we talk, and he doesn't listen to anything. So, in other words, I'm setting this boundary, and he's not going to cross it anymore, because I'm realizing that he's not truly engaging, you know, he's not living, he's not making changes. So he set that boundary. I thought that was just a good illustration of kind of what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that he doesn't love that young man. Doesn't mean he doesn't pray for that young man. But he realizes that setting that boundary probably will actually be the best thing for him ultimately. You know, I mean, he doesn't know, but he does have God's hands. He's not worried about it. Mm-hmm. I doubt he's lost sleep. Like, yeah, so, forgiving does not mean engaging in a relationship with someone again. That's what I said. Yeah, I think that's important too.
Yeah. But I also think that, you know, if you've been hurt personally, you forgive, but it's the devil that keeps wanting to say that you're such a schmuck, and why are you doing that? Right? So we always want to cast out about ourselves. And the devil always wants us to cast out about ourselves and feel like we're not good enough or we're weak or all the things that we don't like about ourselves that keep taking up all the space in our head. That's coming from the devil. So you gotta be a strong man telling
you.
So
maybe these usurping stubbornness.
I think it's, yeah.
No, really, I wanted to want to left one mind more than once. Exactly. And there is a piece there. And really, like that, so it was like 2 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. And he said, well, you have to forgive. And I said, well, I cannot forgive now because I'm not here yet. And don't teach me to lie. I cannot say to you, yeah, I will forgive and then walk out and not even know what to do. I said, no, I don't do that. I'm very open. Very open minded. And I said,
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
know, resentfulness of any kind. So it's kind of like a purification, emotional and spiritual for me. So that's the main reason why I do it. But I usually kind of get a need to kind of protect myself from the person that
that's
did
right.
something.
Yeah, we usually hold on to grudges or whatever we want to call them. In some way, we feel it empowers us and protects us, but it certainly doesn't lead to healing, because that's a toxic thing to have within us. I remember watching something, I don't know if it was like a 60 Minutes or something, it was a show, they were talking about the power of forgiveness, and one of the stories was a woman whose son, teenage son, was shot and killed by another teenage boy. And that boy did his time in prison, I don't know how many years, maybe 15, 20 years. And when he got out, that woman knew about it. And she also knew that he was looking for a home as a convict now. And she lived in a duplex, and she gave him her other home right next to her. And, I mean, I can't do justice to the story. You have to look it up and listen to that. But it was very, very powerful the way she articulated why she forgave and what it meant and did to her and all of these things. I mean, to me, it was very, very, very powerful. Yeah, it was very powerful. So there's something, and she wasn't talking, she's not an Orthodox Christian. It was very powerful, yes.
But it's a similar story. My husband's colleague, he had, I think, 8 kids, not Orthodox. And this was before we knew him, but he had his 5-year-old son. He was with his son. He ran out in the middle of the street and was hit by a car. And on the way to the hospital, they pronounced him dead. And the woman, I don't know who it was, whoever hit him, came to the hospital and was crying hysterically, saying, "I'm so sorry, I killed your son." And he, because he was a very faithful man, albeit Mormon, but he was still a very faithful man. And he said to the woman, "It's okay, I forgive you, it's okay." And at that moment, the doctor said, there's a heartbeat. And they had already pronounced him dead. Now talk about power of forgiveness. I mean, that, his forgiveness, I mean, literally brought his son back. Yeah. Yes, he's now like 30 or something.
Yes.
Isn't that amazing? And it does give you chills.
In my calendar, I write down important things that have happened. And today, March 24, 1999, is the day that NATO bombed Belgrade. How do I ever forgive my friends who are American who think that they are so powerful and so good when they bomb us, their friends, their allies in 2 wars? How do you forgive them for the bombing of this day?
Did they actually fly over and drop the bomb?
Yes.
Yes.
This day
was like a video.
No, her friends.
No, their friends are married.
Okay, well, that's the question I'm asking. Was when you say your friends did that, who are you referring to?
I'm speaking about America being so self-righteous about being the right people and helping, and yet they turned their backs on their allies. And they bombed us on Easter Day, Orthodox Easter. So it looks like they were trying everything they could to hurt us, and how am I going to forget it?
Well, this is obviously a very, very difficult thing. It's another case in point where we're seeing something that is seemingly impossible to do. One thing I would say is we have to be very careful not to throw every American into that incident. Because there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Americans who absolutely rejected that act. They rejected that act. When I was in Greece in 1989, I was at Thessaloniki and I was in a language program, and there were Italians and Germans and Portuguese and there were kids from all over the European Union there who were in the modern Greek program that I was in. And I have never felt such hostility towards me as a person. And they were judging me as an American has arrogance, all these things. I said, wait a minute. I said, you don't even know me. I am not the conscience of my country. I'm not a political figure who's advocating all of these atrocities. You're not even giving me a chance to represent who I am as a person in my own life and faith. So, you know, I think we have to be really, in one thing, one way, to be really careful not to clump every Russian or every Arab or every North Korean into a mindset and an action of a government. Even the people in their own government don't agree with sometimes the actions. You have parties that say, no, don't do this. No, no, we're going to do this. So it's. I think we have to be really careful that we don't generalize in that way, number one. Number two, for those who did commit the crime, okay, the act, those are the ones that we have that hurt from. And I will apply the same logic to what I said to a person who's been physically or sexually abused by someone. We can't expect that person just to kind of forgive and just let it go and love that person again. Yeah. This is where God is asking us to love our enemy, which is almost unconscionable for us at times. But we know that God would not ask of us something that didn't have a divine purpose. Whether we understand it or make sense of it is a totally different thing. And that's why we don't just use platitudes to get people to comply to a passage of Scripture. God says, love your enemies. So love your enemies. What's wrong with you? Aren't you a Christian? That's crazy. That's crazy. So how do you forgive? Only by the grace of God do you forgive. We should never think for a moment that we can do anything like that. If I'm able to forgive, it is because God has given me the grace to do it. If I find it abundantly difficult, almost impossible to forgive this person over here to what he or she did to me when I was 12, let's say, there's no way I can do that. But if God gives me the grace, it's possible. It's possible. That's all. I understand the pain, the hurt, the anger, the rage, all of those things. I understand that. That's not foreign to me. But I also know that I'm worshiping and believing a God who's asking me to do something that is above sort of the human response level. It's a divine response. And it is absolutely possible for me unless God gives me the grace to do it. So the question is, it goes more to my readiness to ask Him for that. I'm not ready to forgive that person. God loves you the same. He desires for you something greater, but He's going to wait on you and your process and all of that. But I think we need to make it a goal to engage the process.